So today I'll summarize work that I've been doing over the past 3 years without really telling you about it. And it sort of spans about eight papers, so it's going to be somewhat dense, though. Optimal control is a problem that shows up in many fields of science and engineering. In neuroscience, it shows up as, you know, when you ask how do people and animals make decisions, both on a cognitive level and also on a low muscle level. You know, how do you decide which muscles to activate? That's what I usually do in neuroscience. But this is really a sort of more fundamental sort of mathematical work that enables you to solve such problems more easily. The reason I started doing this is because, I mean, people have been working on optimal control for 50 years, and people like, say, Rich Sutton, who is here, have developed wonderful algorithms, but the generic problem is just very hard, and despite all these wonderful algorithms, it still remains very hard, and it's really hard to scale it to things like robots moving around, for example. So what I'm doing is I'm formulating the problem in a way that's still very rich and interesting and captures a lot of things we want to study, but at the same time, it's much easier to solve. And what you're going to see throughout this talk is that a lot of the questions that people have been asking can be answered here in sort of new and simpler ways that give rise to more efficient algorithms. So here's how we're going to formulate the problem. So normally you would have some agent that chooses some actions A, and then it lives in some random world. So what these actions do is they determine the transition probabilities from the current states to the next states. That's a normal setting. Now, so what the actions do is they have sort of a roundabout effect. They change some transition probabilities. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to get rid of the actions, these symbolic actions altogether. I'm going to allow the controller to specify these transition probabilities directly. So the controller has the power to override the dynamics of the system in any way it wishes. However, it's going to pay a price for that, and we'll see in a moment. So here's the notation. So X is going to denote the current state. X prime will be the next state. We're going to have a notion of passive dynamics, which is like what the system wants to do if you don't control it. So things like gravity, sort of drifts due to various things, noise, etc. U is going to be the action, so-called action, which is basically a probability distribution that the controller chooses. Now, these are the things it wants to optimize. So there is some state cost, Q, which basically tells you which are good states and which are bad states. You want to go to states where Q is smaller. And here's how we're going to penalize the actions. We're going to measure the so-called KL divergence between the probability distribution we chose and what the system wants to do. Okay? And this KL divergence is basically a measure of how different two probability distributions are. This is the formula for it. And as we're going to see in a moment, this greatly simplifies things. Before we do that, though, let me just try to give you a geometric intuition of what the scale divergence things looks like. So here are two examples. Here's the simplest possible action selection problem, which doesn't involve dynamics, just a coin toss. So I have a coin. It can be heads or tails. Suppose it starts out being unbiased. So the coin wants to be unbiased. Now, all the probability distributions of the coin can be parameterized by the probability of heads, say, which is the number between 0 and 1. The passive dynamics are here in the middle. Coin wants to be unbiased. Now, you can bias it if you want. So your action is to bias the coin. Okay? If you bias it all the way here or here, you're going to get a big action cost. So this is the actual plot of what the KL divergence looks like. Now, suppose you have a cost. You want the coin to be tails. So there's that Q that I said is 0 for tails and 1 for heads, and then the expectation of Q, given your action, is this. So if the coin is fair, then expectation is 0.5. And then if the coin is very unfair, it's 1, et cetera. OK, so what the controller has to do is it has to take into account the state cost, in this case, how much money it's making or losing, and this action cost, which is like how hard is it to actually bias the coin. So for example, imagine if you're in a casino, like you can bias things, but there's a higher and higher chance that the cops are going to catch you. So like you have to balance those two things. When you add up those things, you get something like this, and then the optimal action happens to be here. So now, when you actually have a control problem, you don't have sort of one stage decision, but the dynamics unfolds over time, and that makes things greatly complicated. But this kind of picture is still useful. Here's another example. So this is a shortest path problem. So have a little graph, like you can think of those as cities, and this is, let's say, flights that you can catch between them. And whenever you're in some city, you pay a price of 1. So this is and this is the goal state. So this thing shows you how costly it is to get to the goal. So from here and here and here, it's 1. Now, if you're over here, the passive dynamics here are random walk on the graph. Okay, so the system just wants to go randomly. Now, when you're over here, it doesn't matter if you go here and here, right? So you don't actually have to control the system. Just let it go randomly. That way you pay zero control cost, and then the state cost ends up being two because you add up. Over here, the situation is different. So here, the passive dynamics wants to be random, but it's important for you to go that way and not that way. Okay, so you choose some probability distribution that has the higher probability of going here than here, and now you deviate from the underlying random dynamics, and so you pay some control cost in addition to the state cost. So this state ends up being more expensive than this one. So intuitively, what that says is, suppose you're an absent-minded driver, okay, and you want to get home quickly, but you also want to plan your path through sort of the city in such a way that if you take wrong turns by accident, you're still okay. Okay. In other words, you want to take such a path that you can afford to be random and things are still going to be good. So this sort of this encourages that kind of control policy. Basically, it likes you to be random. Okay, so now let's just look at some of the math. So here's basically the beauty of this class of control problems is that they can be reduced to linear problems. And a linear problem is sort of as simple as it gets. So here's roughly how you do it. So we're going to put a star to denote the optimal control or the best actions you could possibly pick. Now we're going to introduce this function called v of x, which is called the optimal cost to go function. That's a very fundamental sort of quantity that people in this field try to computer approximate. What this says is it says if you start at state x and you act optimally from now until the game ends, how much cost are you expected to accumulate? Okay, so it's a notion of long-term performance. Okay, and now we're going to exponentiate it, and we're going to call this desirability function. So when v is high, this is low, and vice versa. This is something that I'm introducing because it's very useful. Now, I won't really take you through the math, but basically this function v is known to satisfy something called the Bellman equation. When it's basically a minimum over u of the instantaneous cost you pay plus the expected cost to go of the next state. That's what this is. And now we can massage it and play with the properties of log exponential functions, and what we get is that the way this action u affects our Bellman equation is through a minimization of a sort of a transformed KL divergence. And I mean, you can look at the math later if you want, but it's just straightforward algebra, it's just tedious. So the beauty of this is that now, this, like usually when you have an equation like that, you have a minimum over all actions, but there's no way to evaluate this minimum in closed form. So you have to search through all the possible actions one by one. And the action space is really large then, and that takes forever. Well, here, there are infinitely many actions, actually, because there are infinitely many probability distributions. But the way the actions affect this equation is through a function that's known to be convex, and we know what the minimum is. So the KL divergence is zero if and only if the two distributions are equal. So that means that we can actually compute the optimal action in closed form. And it has a very simple, very appealing sort of formula. Basically, the optimal actions are proportional to the passive dynamics, which is what the system wants to do, multiplied by the desirabilities of the state. Okay, so you're somewhere, you want to shape the probability distributions of the dynamics. You take what it wants to do, and you just scale it by how much you desire to go to every state, where this desirability is computed by solving this equation, and then you're done. So it's a very simple form of choosing action. And so then all it comes down to computing this desirability function. Now, since this whole thing drops and becomes zero, and the rest simplifies to this equation. So this desirability function satisfies now a linear Bellman equation. So basically, the desirability of each state is the following. You multiply by the state cost at this state, and then you take the expectation under the passive dynamics of the desirabilities of the next state. And that's a linear equation. So you can write it in vector notation as some vector of z is equal to some known matrix times z. So we reduced optimal control to a linear problem, and like I said, that's basically as good as it's ever going to get. Short of finding a closed-form solution for a specific special case, of course. Now, let's just illustrate very briefly this idea of desirabilities and control. So suppose this is your current state. Suppose P of X, bar given X, a passive dynamic. So if this is here, the passive dynamics wants to go to states that are distributed like that. This happens to be your desirability function that you computed somehow. You multiply the red by the black. And what that will do is will tend to take some sort of bump of probability, and it's going to shift it towards states that are more desirable. And then the next state is actually going to be sampled from the shifted thing. Now, you can make these bumps sort of very narrow, they're almost delta functions, and then when you multiply them by this thing, it's going to shift those delta functions a little bit. What I just described is, so there are different ways to define long-term performance in these problems. What I was just describing was implicitly assuming that you're going to run until you hit some terminal state, and then that's when the game ends. That's called first exit problem often. You can define it in other ways. You can do a finite horizon where you run until a predefined time, or you can run forever and then you average the cost per step, or you can run forever and you can do exponential discounting of the cost. So you get similar results for all these cases. The only one that leads to a nonlinear equation is the exponentially discounted one. All the others are linear equations. So now let's apply this to a few things. Here's the application to shortest path. So we're actually going to take a classic shortest path problem and turn it into a linear problem and approximate it. Okay, so suppose you have some graph. You're going to define the passive dynamics as the random walk on the graph. And we're going to define the state cost. Basically, it's going to be zero if it's terminal state, and some positive constant if it's non-terminal. So, well, then you can see that that optimal cost to go function is basically going to be the length of the shortest path multiplied by rho, plus some control costs that you pick up along the way. But these control costs are sort of bounded and fixed, while you can make this rho as big as you want. So then if you divide by rho and you take the limit of rho going to infinity, you're going to recover exactly the shortest path. So now, you can, not only are you going to take the limit, you're just going to set rho to something sufficiently large, and now you can solve shortest path problems by typing backslash in MATLAB, basically, because you're solving a linear equation. So it's a one-line solution to shortest path problems. This is a test on a sort of moderately sized graph of internet routers that are downloaded somewhere from the web. It has that many nodes, that many edges. I can compute exactly the shortest paths using dynamic programming, and this is the, so they're between 1 and 15, and they're lots of paths that are equal to one of those numbers. This is the approximation. You always overestimate a little bit because you're adding these extra control costs, but then you can make this approximation error small enough. So in this case, if you round down to the nearest integer, which you should because you know you're overestimating, it turns out that it gets the shortest path exactly for every node. You can also, I mean, more generally, you can take a traditional MDP is called a Markov decision problem. It's usually how people define optimal control problems in discrete domains. So you can take anything that has actions U and transition probabilities, call them P tilde, and some costs L, and you can embed that into our family of control problems. And by embedding mean that you're going to construct this state cost and the passive dynamics in such a way that the costs are matched. So here's what this means. So for every state and every action, this is how much cost you're going to pay in the original problem. And this is the cost in our problem. So this is the state cost, and this is the KL divergence between the passive dynamics and an action which is equal to whatever your symbolic action is going to give you. So what this means is that we basically have some symbolic actions that are a finite set, and they correspond to some probability distributions. Now, our controller is free to choose those probability distributions, or it could choose other probability distributions that don't correspond to anything in this original problem. Okay, so it's a continuous relaxation of the problem. So we embed it in this way, and then we solve it, and then we get something that can be a good approximation to what we started with. Here's a sort of a slightly modified classic problem. It's called the machine repair problem, and I'm not going to go through details, but basically this is what we're trying to approximate. This is what we're getting. They correspond very well. We can do things like learning through stochastic approximation methods. So here's how we do that. Remember, this is the equation we got. We're trying to solve for this function and satisfy this equation. Now, the way you build sort of online stochastic approximation methods is that you find an expectation somewhere, and you get rid of it, and you replace it with a sample average, basically. So this equation can be approximated online in this way. So here we're going to sample from the passive dynamics. So that's kind of interesting. So we're learning about the optimal way to control the system by sampling from the passive dynamics. Otherwise, not controlling it at all, just watching it what it does, and that's good enough to learn how to control optimally, which is kind of interesting. And the update rule you do is the following. So it's a lookup table approximation to this function. You have some learning rate data. You're mixing your old approximation with the new approximation that comes from here, basically, without expectation. There's an algorithm in reinforcement learning, which is also off-policy method, that is called Q-learning. It attempts to approximate a bigger function. Basically, this so-called Q function is a function of states and actions. It says, if I'm in this state, and if I take this action, what's the cost from now on? This function Z is a much smaller function. It's only a function over the state space. So we have a learning roof that is an off-policy method, but it approximates a much smaller quantity, so of course it's going to work faster. Here's some examples showing that it works faster. Nothing surprising there. I mean, we just basically got a lot of mileage out of analytical work, and then, of course, the rest that's numerical is faster. Now, everything I said so far was set up in a discrete domain. Now, it turns out there is a continuous analog to these things. And the continuous analog looks like that. So you have some state vector x. It could be, say, the positions and velocities of my arm. You have some passive dynamics or drift, which has to do with gravity, nonlinear interaction forces, some force fields that are acting on it. Then you have some control u, and then you have some noise. And then you have some sort of control gain matrix that maps control, that tells you how the controls push the system, basically. So these can be nonlinear functions of x, but this has to enter linearly, and the noise has to be in the same space as the controls. For example, if I'm controlling my arm, this means that the noise lives in the same space where I can actuate things. So it's a bit of a limitation. For example, if this pointer is sitting here and I'm reaching for it, the noise can shake my arm because I can control it, but it cannot shake the pointer directly. And then you can have a cost rate, which is basically any function of the state, but the control has to enter quadratically like that. And these two things are coupled. So for these problems, you can show that we can do all sort of similar simplifications. You get a control law in closed form, and then your desirability function satisfies some linear differential equations in this case, except for the discounted case where the equation ends up being nonlinear. Now, it's not immediately obvious why this discrete problem and this control problem are analogs, and the way you show that is you take the discrete problem and take a certain limit to continuous space and continuous time, and the limit is somewhat tricky, so I'm not even going to attempt to explain it, but you can find it in my papers. Now, that gives us a new way to discretize continuous systems. So usually when you're trying to solve a continuous control problem, you discretize the state space, and then you solve it with one of the methods for dynamic programming. Here I'm giving you an example of something called a car on a hill. So it's basically a point mass constrained to move on a curved surface, and it has to go here and stop. It's the parking lot. So the state space is position and velocity. This is what the optimal cost to go looks like. It's the parking lot. This is the optimal control. Control is just a scalar force that's pushing one or the other. This is some trajectory sample from it, from different initial states. So what this shows you is this is a standard dynamic programming method for computing this problem, and it has actually some free parameters that I've tweaked to make it as fast as possible. There's another method called value iteration, which is really slow. It will almost look like that in this case. This thing is something which I'm calling Z iteration, which is basically an iterative way to solve a linear equation. You can also solve it with a direct solver, but just for comparison. So it's basically about 10 times faster, which, again, is not at all surprising, because what this is so... Things like policy iteration and value iteration are approximating things and then minimizing and then approximating again. Here, the minimization is done once and for all analytically before you even start, and then all you're doing is solving linear equations. Now, of course, you cannot discretize large state spaces, so the main thing we're working on is develop function approximation methods that are going to scale up to higher dimensionality. So here's the basic idea. So you're going to represent your unknown function, z, that you're trying to compute, as some linear combination of basis functions. It's very convenient to choose those bases as Gaussians because analytically convenient things happen. We're going to parameterize those Gaussians with means and covariances that are contained in some parameter vector theta, which is here. So it's like a radio basis function network, but we can actually adapt the means and covariances of the Gaussians. Now, just as a side note, that like people often tell you that, oh yeah, you can pick some features in advance and then do everything linear, and that's really a misnomer. Because, yeah, if you happen to know the solution to the problem, you can pick one of the features to be the solution to the problem, and then you're done. But if you don't know the solution to the problem, if you're in some very high-dimensional space, then your features that you pick randomly are never going to really span everything you need. So, and we found here that, you know, if you throw a bunch of Gaussians randomly, the solution is really bad. But if you allow them to adapt their means and covariances, then all of a sudden it gets really much better. So anyway, so you have linear mixtures of Gaussians, but we can adapt the Gaussians. Now, we can take these functional equations and turn them into equations about the weights and also the means and covariances of the Gaussians. So these equations are linear in the vector of weights. So these matrices F and G are basically evaluate all the basis functions and all the collocation states. So basically, we picked a bunch of states where we want to enforce the equation. And similarly for this matrix. So we get equations like that. They're linear in W, so we can solve them with backslash or an eigensolver in this case. they're nonlinear in these means and covariances, but it turns out that Gauss-Newton methods actually work quite efficiently and they converge reasonably well. So we're now scaling this up to higher dimensional things. Here's some two-dimensional examples we started with. So this is our car on the hill. Now we want it to cycle. So there are two desired states, but there are also desired velocities that are non-zero. So this is an infinite horizon problem. So this is what the cost looks like. This is an optimally controlled stochastic trajectory. This is position, this is velocity. This is the discrete solution. This is what this function Z looks like. This is what the control law should look like. This is the limit cycle. This is what the car will do if you don't perturb it. Now, this is computed with 40,000 discrete states. Okay? And 40,000 is, you know, it seems like a lot, but if you go to a 10-dimensional state space, you're going to need a lot more than that. Now, we can get away with only 40 adaptive Gaussians, which decided to go to these positions, and we're getting a control law that actually is very similar. Again, these points kind of look random. But if you throw them randomly and you set the covariances randomly, the solution is just a complete disaster. So after you allow them to adapt, they go to some places which are not at all obvious why they're good places, and yet they are because we get much better solutions. Here's a similar thing. Here's the inverted pendulum, except it has walls. So it can, if it hits the wall, the velocity drops to zero. And the task is to be a metronome. So basically, velocity has to be either positive or negative, but constant. So it has to be called that. This is what the function Z looks like. This is the approximation. So these methods work well. We're now trying to scale them up. Here's a really beautiful property of these problems. So it allows us to compute the optimal solutions to a few problems, and then we can combine them and obtain new solutions. And we're guaranteed that the new solutions are the optimal solutions to some other problems. So in other words, we can build building blocks for optimal control, and then we can compose them sort of in closed form, and we're guaranteed we're getting optimal solutions. The reason we can do that is because this function Z satisfies a linear equation. And the solutions to linear equations can be added, and then you get new solutions for different boundary conditions, basically. So this holds for either first exit problem or finite horizon problems. Suppose your boundary cost or final cost for the problem you want to solve can be represented in this way. So it's a log of some weighted combination of exponents of a bunch of boundary costs that you have already solved for. Okay? So you get a bunch of BKs, you find the corresponding ZKs, which are your solutions, and then if you have a new problem which can be represented like this for some weights, then the solution to this problem is simply the weighted combination of these Zs, and then the control law can be found correspondingly. You can also compose things that are not solutions to actual control problems, but there's some more natural primitives that somehow span the space optimally. And you can actually define what optimal is. So you can consider something called the Green's function, which is basically linear mapping from the boundary to the interior of the solution. So Green's function. It's usually defined for differential equations. Here we're actually applying it to integral equations, but it doesn't matter. So what you get is Z on the boundary, Z on the interior related by some matrix. If you do singular value decomposition of that matrix, you get some sort of natural control primitives. So I'm going to illustrate these two ideas. The first one, where you actually solve a bunch of control problems, is illustrated with something called a linear quadratic problem. So if you have linear dynamics, quadratic cost, and Gaussian noise, you can actually write down the formula for the solution. Okay. So now what we're going to do is take a bunch of those and combine them and solve problems in closed form that we couldn't solve before. In particular, the cost functions are no longer going to be quadratic. So here's a simple sort of one-dimensional system. It has position, time, it has some final cost, and then this cost to go is some sort of quadratic at every point in time. This is the control law. For this type of system, the control laws are linear feedback control laws, meaning that the optimal control is just some proportion of the state, and the gain changes, the gain is the slope. So now if I combine two of those, I can get a sort of bimodal cost function, and the control law looks like that. I can combine a bunch of those, and I get a function which basically doesn't care where you are within a certain region, but then it cares. So this is sort of it gives you a margin of error. And then the control law, the optimal control law, is like that. So we can, you know, this is already convenient. We can apply it to other nonlinear problems. So here's a problem where the boundary is the disk. I define some dynamics, which is this blue vector field. This L thing is an obstacle, just to make it more fun. The red thing is the final cost. So basically, the task is to exit the disk here as quickly as you can. This is the solution for that function Z, so it's really basically good to be here. It's kind of okay to be here because the passive dynamics is going to push you to the exit and you don't have to do anything. It's sort of not so good to be here. The log of that is the optimal cost to go function, so it has more structure. Now, I've taken these singular values, and this is what they look like. And then by composing different numbers of them, I can get variously accurate approximations to this. So what's interesting is that if you look at those singular vectors, there are a few of them that are kind of global and that do stuff everywhere. And then when you go to high-order ones, they're only modulated near the boundary. What that means is that you can cut off all the high-order components, and that's going to tell you how to act in most of the state space. And only when you get close to the goal or to the boundary, only then you have to do more accurate things. So this is sort of a quick and dirty way to tell you what to do in most of the state space, right? Because most of the state space is actually in the interior. So we're hoping also that this thing is going to scale. Am I hopelessly out of time?
I'm
sorry. I am. I put Gary to sleep so much.
You shouldn't have said anything.
Okay. Okay, good. Well, since Gary's not paying attention, I'll keep talking. Okay, I'll have maybe three more slides or so. So turns out that this family of optimal control problems is mathematically equivalent to Bayesian estimation. Now, the way you show that is, well, roughly like so. So you take your optimal control law, which is the state transition, and then if you write it in sort of a finite horizon, it ends up having this form. So before it was just this times this, but there was a scaling constant that I didn't show you. The scaling constant happens to be this times this, actually. So if you now take a trajectory and you ask, what is the probability that my optimally controlled system travels through a certain trajectory? When you do that, all these ZT plus 1s and ZT are going to cancel when you take a product. And so the probability of a trajectory is actually something very simple. It's just the probability of the pairwise passive transition probabilities times the exponentiated state costs. Okay? Now, for those of you who are Bayesians, you're going to recognize this as the probability of a hidden trajectory for a partially observable system, where this is the dynamics or prior, and then these are likelihoods of the observations. So we can set up an estimation problem where we don't control anything. The system is just unfolding according to its passive dynamics. We want to infer the state. We're making some measurements whose probabilities are proportional to these exponentiated state costs. And if we do that, we're guaranteed that the posterior probability distribution in that Bayesian estimation problem is equal to our trajectory probability in the control problem. This sort of sets up more formally what the dual control and estimation problems are. So what I just said is you, in the control problem, you control it in whatever way you want. You pay a price, which is the state cost plus the KL divergence. Estimation problem is it moves according to the passive dynamics, and then you get some measurements whose log probability is equal to a state cost, and continuous time will get something that I won't go through. Here's just a hand-waving picture, but maybe actually useful. So you know that there are things like belief networks that tell you how to do Bayesian estimation and motivate various algorithms. So now we can take this and apply them to control, because we have shown that this class of control problems is actually equivalent to estimation. Normally in estimation, you have world states that are unknown. There are sensory inputs that you observe. You have a probabilistic generative model that relates these to this, and then you apply sort of Bayes rule over time to invert that and figure out what this is. Here what we're doing is we have planned states. We have a dynamics model, which is actually the same as this dynamics model. And then there's a mapping from here to here, which for the lack of a better word I'm calling forward kinematics. So what this is you pretend that you have observed the task goals being accomplished, and then you infer what did the system do in order to accomplish those goals. Okay? Now, if you set up the probabilities in the right way, that inference, the solution to that inference problem actually tells you how to control the system optimally in order to accomplish those goals. Just how the math works out. Because that, if you look at that trajectory probability, you can also interpret that, if you take the log of that, you can interpret that as some sort of modified cost function. So this is also the solution to a deterministic optimal control problem, which is kind of a unique property. So we start with a stochastic problem, and now we're saying that if you control it optimally, the most likely trajectory of the stochastic problem is the solution to a deterministic problem with modified cost. And the modification has to do with the logs of the passive dynamics. In continuous case, it has to do with something with the log, the determinant of the noise covariance, and the divergence of the passive dynamics, which is kind of interesting. Here's an example where, just look at this plot. So the red thing is the probability mass under the optimally controlled system, and this black thing is the deterministic trajectory we're getting, and so they're very close. What happened? Oh. Well, there's one more.
You had your three slides.
Okay, well, here's the... Okay, this actually is the last one. Okay, so the last thing we can do is solve the problem of inverse optimal control, which is actually kind of important for things like cognitive science. So often you want to, or neuroscience. So often you want to observe some animal or human, and you suspect they're optimal, but you don't know what they're optimizing, right? And so the question is, given their actions, can I infer the cost function? Okay, people like Andrew Ng and Peter Abel and others have come up with algorithms, but these algorithms are very computationally intensive because what they do is they guess the cost function, they solve the optimal control problem, they compare the predicted performance to what the subject did, and then they kind of tweak the guess for the cost and iterate. And sometimes solving the optimal control problem even once is really hard. Here it turns out that the inverse problem is actually much easier than the forward problem. So here we can basically, I won't go through this, but basically there is a thing we have to optimize with respect to the cost function, it turns out to be convex. So gradient descent converges in like 4 iterations. And there's some random problems where these are the actual costs, these are the ones we estimated. This is how the estimates improve with when the data gets more. Okay, this is the bunch of papers that you can read on my website if you have nothing better to do. Thank you.
So getting to cognitive science, so there's problems of executive control. So if you have a model of how people make decisions, there's questions about people have biases for making certain responses based on previous histories. You have speed accuracy trade-offs. You have to decide thresholds for accumulating evidence for particular decisions. Can these algorithms be used as potential models of executive control to see how people respond to those contingencies over time to respond in a way that may or may not be optimal?
If you believe that executive control is optimal with respect to something, the answer is yes. If you want to model things like reaction times, then you need a mechanistic model of how these things are implemented. I haven't given you that, but I'm sure this could be used as a basis.
I mean, we have models that do a pretty good job of accounting for things like response times for decisions. So I guess it's how you would control the parameters of those models.
Yeah, I mean, so the parameters are the passive dynamics, which are probably pretty straightforward in executive decision task, although they could be funny if people want to have some weird biases. You could use that to model. Yeah, maybe we should talk, basically.
Yeah, okay. I'll talk to you.